Thank you for inviting me again. And if I remember correctly, when you first reached out to me about this conference, you know, there hadn't been any Supreme Court rulings yet. It was more of just, you know, if you thought it'd be an interesting topic, and it became especially relevant and heated. And to that end, you know, I do not plan to discuss politics or tell people what I think they should do with their bodies. It's really just a discussion about what are the classic Jewish sources that inform this discussion. I'll let you make your own conclusions, though. I mean, I'm happy to discuss, I mean, if you have questions or comments or thoughts. And I'll share a little bit, you know, you mentioned my work in the hospital. I will share a little bit about, like, what are the specific questions that we face on a regular basis in the hospital today? And how do those questions relate to these sources? Again, not giving very specific practical suggestions, or of course, definitely not political suggestions, but at least trying to address the kind of contemporary modern issues that we face. And so what I want to do is really take you through some of the primary sources and analyze them a bit with you. And I'm trying, it is a very complicated topic. I mean, everything in Jewish law, especially that goes back thousands of years, meaning some topics in medical ethics world of Jewish law are contemporary. And you know, when you talk about certain, you know, issues, the rabbis could never have imagined them. But that's not true when it comes to the question of abortion. There is a tremendous amount of discussion of it in the Talmudic literature and actually in the biblical literature. And so what we'll do is I'll take you through some of those sources going back to the beginning, to the book of Exodus. And then, you know, we'll analyze and discuss, and I'll share again with you, you know, my experience in the world today, and we'll see where you want to go with it from there. But I'm trying to simplify it as much as possible, even though it is a complicated topic, and I want to do it justice, but I also want it to be kind of comprehensible and manageable. So I'm going to take you first to the very first source. I'm going to share my screen. I'll go back and forth between sharing and then kind of going back to the group screen, and then we'll make sure, obviously, to have time for conversation and discussion. Though in the meantime, feel free to put anything into the chat. So here's the first source, and it's interesting for a lot of reasons. The Torah itself. The Torah talks about killing a fetus. Now, not in terms of abortion, but the classic question always often is, you know, what's the value of a fetus's life in Jewish law? And
even just email me as
that
well.
That can she... be, Faith, don't mind muting yourself. That can be inferred from the verses. So the verse says in the book of Exodus, this is Parsha Mishpatim, that's right after the Ten Commandments. It's not the Ten Commandments, but it's right after that, where there's a long list of laws. So the first thing it says is, Maka ish vamet motumat. If a person kills another person and they die, there is capital punishment in the Torah. Now, that's a different conversation, capital punishment, because the rabbis in the Talmud limited it very significantly to the point of almost making it such something that could almost never happen. But anyways, the Torah itself does require capital punishment for killing an adult, for killing a person. What about a fetus? Well, you have to infer it from another verse. The next verse says, V'chiyinatsu anashim. But let's say two men are fighting, and imagine like a group has kind of surrounded those men watching them fight, which sometimes happens, right? V'nagfu isha hara. And while they're fighting, they accidentally hit a pregnant woman, v'yatsu yaldeha. And the children come out, v'lo ye'ason, but they don't die, they live. So they induce birth, they induce labor delivery. But the kids are okay, the babies are okay. So anosh anosh kasher yashit alav bala isha benatam plalim. So there shall be, you know, they have to pay for the damages of hurting the woman, and that's it. You know, there are obviously no damages to the babies; they survived. Vimasonie, but if there is an ason, if there is a tragedy, ason throughout the Tanakh means tragedy, or I have it here as fatality. If there's a death, venatata nefesh tachet nefesh. But if there will be death, and that's assumed there that it means death of the mother is killed, then there will be death penalty. Now, the classic understanding is actually different than the way I read it just now. The classical understanding of the rabbis, and this is going to get important, is in the second verse there, v'chinatzu anashim v'nakfui shahara, the woman is pregnant, v'yatzei yaldeh v'lo yeson, that there's no fatality there. It's actually of the mother. The mother survives, but yatzu yaldeha means the baby's died, the fetus has died. So now in that case, now this is the way the rabbis understand it. In the case where the fetus has died, there will be monetary damages. But if the mother dies, nefesh tachat nefesh, then there is capital punishment. So you see from that, that if it's in the rabbi's understanding, this is going to be important in a second, the rabbi's understanding of the verse, a fetus does not have the status of a life. Because you see that from the fact that the damages are paid for the loss of the fetus, but not capital punishment. Interestingly, and I'm not going to go in depth with this because it's not my expertise or my place to talk about, but we know that Christianity has a different approach, at least the Catholic Church in particular has a different approach to abortion than this, right? Typically, they are very strict about abortion and forbidding abortion. But we share the same Bible, you know, what we call the Old Testament. How do they deal with this verse? If this verse seems to be clearly saying that if there is a death to the fetus, there's only monetary damages, whereas if there's a death to the mother, there is capital punishment. That seems to be clear, that the fetus does not have the status of a human. The problem is, the issue is, that the Septuagint, Philo, about 2,000 years ago, there was the first major translation of the Torah. It was into Greek. And this was very controversial. The rabbis did not want to allow a translation because they were worried about how people would misunderstand it, what they would do with it, but they translated it. And there were some differences between the ways that the Septuagint was translated and how the rabbis understood the verses. And the Septuagint reading, I'll read the verses again to you, but change the translation of that word ason. They understood the word ason to mean form. Form as in showing, you know, like they often talk about a pregnant woman after about 3 months is showing, right? You can see that that she is pregnant. So if you read it that way, so then the verse says as follows. Two men are fighting and they accidentally strike a pregnant woman. And the children come out, the children have died. But they were not yet showing. In that case, then they have to pay damages. But if she was showing, there was form, the babies, the fetuses were already developed enough to be recognizable, then it's nefesh tachat nefesh, then it's a full life. And in fact, if you look back at the earliest writings in the Catholic Church, the very first popes, for example, argued that abortion is murder from 3 months, from the time she is showing. The conception, the murder from conception, the birth, the status from conception is actually later. That gradually the Catholic Church changed their approach to that. But this is where the difference came in. Is ason mean, does it mean a fatality and referring to the mother? Or does it mean fatality, but it's referring to a formed fetus? The rabbis understood it to mean that it's only when there is the death of the mother is there capital punishment. When there's death of the fetus, it is monetary damages. That's one thing. So that's up for debate. Anyways, the rabbis were very clear, though, in the Mishnah. The Mishnah, and this is going to become really the main source because the commentaries and the way they go with it will lead us down two different paths. The Mishnah, so the first rabbinic writings, also going back a little over 2,000 years, the Mishnah in Ohalot, the rabbis said as follows, and this is very, very important. People talk about this a lot, but there's reasons why we need to sort of nuance this discussion. Ha'isha shimak shalele. What if a woman is having difficulty in childbirth? Difficult labor. So the rabbi said, this is from the Mishnah, this is classic Jewish law, Mechatchin et havlad b'me'eha, we cut up the vlad, the fetus within her, umotzino so evarim evarim, and they are removed limb by limb, b'pnei shechayeha kodmin lechayav, because her life comes before the fetus's life. However, yatsa rubo, but when the majority of the fetus has come out, ein nogimbo, then we cannot kill the fetus. She'ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh, because we don't kill one life for the other life. And Rashi there, his understanding, Rashi explains, classic commentary, hachai poshetet yada, the maid wife, the maid servant, the midwife, reaches in, and cuts it up. This is what they call like D&C type of abortion today. It's very similar to what's practiced today. In fact, I'll tell you a story about that. And cuts up the fetus to remove it. This is to save the mother's life. Techoz manchalo yatza lavir olam. As long as the fetus does not come out of the womb, lav nefesh hu, it is not considered a soul, or I think a more proper translation is, it does not have the status of a person yet. V'nitin l'hargo l'hatzilat imo. And you are therefore allowed to kill it to save its mother, because it's threatening the life of the mother, and the life of the mother is a full life, whereas the fetus does not yet have the status of a life. Aval yatsa rosho. But once its head comes out, ein no gimbo l'hargo, you cannot kill it, v'havet le kigilud, because then it is considered a life, even though it's, you know, 1 second old. The ein b'yochi nefesh, you've been nefesh, we do not give status to one life over the other life. It's actually, you know, it's very interesting, because this ruling of the Mishnah that a fetus does not have the status of a life yet, that's obviously very relevant, right? At what point does, according to Jewish law, a fetus develop the status of a human being? That's at not conception, nor is it at 3 months. It's at birth. Once it comes out. It's interesting, by the way, modern technology might have brought up an interesting wrinkle to this, by the way, because, you know, it is now possible to do fetal surgeries where the fetus remains in the mother. There's a surgery that happens that the fetus is partially exposed and somewhat removed from the uterus for the surgery to happen, then replaced back into the fetus in order to continue to gestate, and then is born a few months later. And the question could, a modern question could be, well, does it now have the status of a life because it has entered the world, so to speak, even though it then went back? Which is a very interesting question, which there isn't really yet set precedent for or answers to. Different rabbis give different opinions. Some say, because it says, Misha yatsa mi avira olam, which comes into the air, it has to have taken a breath. If it hasn't taken a breath yet, it's not yet considered a life by Jewish law. But interestingly, I'll just tell you a quick story related to this. Because this, you know, DNC type of abortion that still happens today, where a fetus is, you know, cut up to be removed to save the mother's life, that still happens. I do a class, you mentioned in your introduction that I teach these seminars to high school students, where they come to the hospital for a few sessions, and we go to what we have this simulation center here, where you can come into like a real, you really feel like you're in a hospital room, and you even have fake patients that are so real that they have blood pressure, they have organs, they bleed, they could die. I mean, it's really amazing. And you can learn medical ethics, you know, you can talk about scenarios and do them yourself. So one time we had a week with a group in the simulation center. And so we were just trying different things and we were having discussions, and then the simulation center would just say to us, okay, you talked about, you know, end of life therapies. Okay, let's go do it. Let's go do that surgery. Let's do that extubation, you know, whatever it is. So we had a conversation about abortion. So the simulation center said to us, oh, you want to do an abortion? We could do one right here, right now. So the kids were like very excited. They said, yeah, let's see what it's like. So they actually called a physician to come down the next day. We did it the next day. We had to prepare for it. And they set up a mannequin that looks extremely lifelike, and they put a fetus inside of it. Obviously, this is all fake. It's simulated, but it looks real. And they had an OBGYN who does abortions come and walk us through it. And first, we had a discussion. What we do is have discussions, do the action, and then discuss again. Particular group was very strong in their feelings that, abortion should be allowed in all circumstances. And that was our discussion. So then, and I had no idea what was going to happen. I did not have an agenda here whatsoever. And they said, okay, we're going to go do the abortion. It's in this scenario, the fetus is now 5 months in gestation, and we're going to do a DNC procedure. So they had kids go in there and, you know, use these tools to then cut up the fetus and remove it limb by limb, exactly what the Mishnah, the rabbis were talking about, which the rabbi said is allowed. But the kids, and I was so scared. After the kids all started crying. They were high school seniors, very sophisticated. You know, I say kids, they're 18 years old. And we went back to the room. Everyone's crying. And they were like, that's abortion? And I also was like, I don't know. They were like, I thought you just like take a pill and then you just done and you move on. I didn't know you cut up a fetus. And they were like, we have to reevaluate this. They were like shocked. I was like, I'm going to get calls from parents tonight. I'm going to be in so much trouble. I was like, please, I didn't know that's what we were going to do. I promise I didn't have an agenda here. But it was like, it was a little bit of a wake-up call just in terms of like how graphic it is and something to think about. It's not such a simple thing. And we see with women oftentimes, just speaking as a chaplain, you know, there is often moral trauma, sort of emotional trauma that comes along with it. So it's not a simple thing. But of course, and this is exactly, this is responding to your question, going back to the source did say, the rabbi said, if the mother's life is at risk, we have to do whatever we can to save her life. And even though in Jewish law, you don't kill one person to save another person, right? If you have two, you know, you can't just kill one to save another. All life is of equal value. But the rabbi said very, very clearly that the fetus does not have the status of a life, lav nefeshi, and therefore you would destroy the fetus, kill the fetus in order to save the mother's life. That is very clearly the law in the Mishnah. And we saw the commentary of Rashi, which said that because, in our opinion, Rashi says, that our tradition, a fetus does not have the status of a human being until it is born. So until then, if you have to, we don't want to, we don't think it's a great, wonderful thing, but if you have to do it, you have to do it. So that's what Rashi said. Now, here's where this gets a little bit more complicated, because that was Rashi's commentary. Lav nefeshu, right? You can kill the fetus to save the mother's life because the fetus does not have the status of a life. But Maimonides gives a different reason of why you're allowed to kill the fetus in order to save the mother's life. He says the reason is based on a different law. There is a law, I just said, and let me actually go back to just not sharing the screen for a second so we can just talk about it. There is a law in Judaism called Rodef. Even though I said you cannot kill one person to save another, because all life is of equal value, then so too, there's one distinction with that. What if someone is coming to kill someone? Someone is coming to kill a person, and there's no way to stop them. The only way to stop them would be to kill them to prevent them from killing you. So in self-defense, that's the one time Judaism allows killing. And that is, the Mishnah says, Habada hargecha, hashkein vahargo. Someone comes to kill you, get up and kill them first. Of course, if you can hide or if you can just injure them and stop them, that's better. But if you have to kill them, then you may kill them to stop them from killing you. That's called a rodef. That person has the status of a rodef. Rodef, the word means a chaser. If they're chasing you, you kill them to stop them if that's your only choice. Maimonides says, and this changed the whole discussion about abortion. Maimonides says, the reason why you can kill the fetus to save the mother is because that fetus is as if it is chasing after her to kill her. Now, some of the rabbis say, wait a second. Once a fetus is born, it's not a rodef anymore. You can't kill it anymore. If we have to give the reason of rodef, the only reason you kill a rodef is if it's coming to kill you. That must mean that it's as if it's murder to kill the fetus, but it's justified murder to save the mother's life. So there was a tradition among some rabbis, and we'll discuss this in a minute, that actually abortion is murder. It could be justified in certain situations, but it has the status of murder. And that's important. Actually, you know, a lot of people are talking about this lately. I heard a rabbi talking about this, and he said, you know, in Judaism, no one ever said abortion is murder. That's not Jewish. That's Christian. That's what this rabbi said in this very public, very large lecture. And that's actually not true. Just for the sake of intellectual honesty. And I'm going to share more sources soon. But there is a tradition among some that it is murder. But it can be justified murder in certain situations. So that's our first two sources. So let me just summarize what we've said so far, because I don't want it to be too complicated. And then we're going to go two steps deeper, and then we'll be able to kind of pause there and discuss. So number one, we said that according to the Torah, it seems clear, according to the rabbi's way of reading the Torah, that even though the Torah has capital punishment for murder, the Torah only stipulates damages, monetary damages, for killing a fetus. That seems to imply that a fetus does not have the same status of a human being. True, though, that the Septuagint and thereafter, the Catholic Church read that word to mean form, and thus they were of the opinion that a fetus does have the status of a human once there's form, once it's 3 months gestation. But the rabbis took a different approach, which became clear in the Mishnah, that the Mishnah then said that if the fetus is somehow posing danger to the mother's life, you kill the fetus, you abort the fetus to save the mother's life. But then we saw there's two different understandings of why that's allowed. Rashi, the most important commentary on the Torah, and Tanakh and the whole Talmud says that the reason why you can abort a fetus to save the mother's life is because the fetus does not have the status of a human until it's born. Until it's born. Whereas Maimonides, who's also very important, said that the reason you could kill the fetus is because it's like a rodent. It's chasing her life. And we're not sure what he meant by that, but some understood Maimonides to mean that it must be that otherwise it would be murder to kill the fetus unless the fetus is threatening the mother's life. That's what we're up to so far. Now I want to go one step further, but let's ask another modern question, and I'll show you why this is relevant. What about embryonic stem cell research? Right, abortion is not only a question of a pregnant woman who doesn't want to carry this baby to term for the fetus to term for whatever reason, whether it's a risk to her life emotionally or physically or other reasons that we'll talk about in a minute. But what about, you know, just talking about science, lab research, right? What if you have an embryonic stem cell? So just to a very quick rewind, stem cells, you know, all of us began as pluripotent, as first totipotent stem cells, right, in a blastocyst stage. In just the first couple of days of fertilization, when a sperm and egg come together, for a few days, it's just a ball of cells, right? Just if you look at it under a microscope, it's a ball. It's called a blastocyst, a bunch of circles. And each of those cells will become different parts of the human being. Some will become the brain. Some will become arms. Some will become toes. They all look the same, though, at that point. And if it could become anything, which that for scientists is very valuable because you can then take those pluripotent stem cells and induce them to become anything you want. And therefore you could, in the future, you know, we'll be able to grow, let's say, a new kidney, right? Someone needs a kidney. Instead of waiting for an organ donor, you can grow a new kidney, or you can repair a damaged heart tissue or whatever it is. There's lots of things we can do with stem cells. The thing is, those stem cells, as I just mentioned, they come from an embryo. Okay, today researchers have found ways to take adult stem cells and rewind them to the pluripotent stage, but that's a different discussion. But what about embryonic stem cells? Taking stem cells from an embryo and then using them for science, for medicine. So in many ways, and I promise I'm not picking on the Catholic Church, I'm just using it today as a, you know, obviously a very legitimate position, but I'm just using it as a contrast. The Catholic Church felt strongly that embryonic stem cell research is the type of abortion. You're taking embryos that could have been human beings and then using them for other purposes, and oftentimes not using them at all because they're discarded frequently. So the truth is this conversation goes for lots of fertility treatments, because frequently even it takes fertility treatments to have a baby, many of the pre-embryos are discarded. So all those questions. In the strongest anti-abortion camp, that's considered abortion and therefore forbidden and can't be used. And that's why government funding often in America, I promise I'm not getting political here, I'm just saying facts. Often, you know, funding for embryonic stem cells often depends on who the president is. And some administrations will support it and some will not. And often that's based on the whole abortion question. So what does Judaism say about embryonic stem cell research? So we have a source for that as well. And the truth is, this came up once. Just imagine the scenario and how the rabbi has to be thinking. There was, in the ultra-Orthodox city of Bnei Brak, there was one time a fertility lab full of embryonic stem cells. And they had, on one Shabbat, there was a power outage. Now, they're all frozen, right? They're frozen pre-embryos in there. If you have a power outage, you have a big problem because they're going to defrost and die. So they came to the rabbi and they said, "Rabbi, tell us what to do, quick. The fertility center, the power went out. They've lost their power. They're going to all defrost. Can we turn on the generator to save them?" That would be a prohibition of the Sabbath. It constitutes fire. There's fire. I mean, the generator is like an engine. Can I break the Sabbath to turn on the engine that will save these embryos? Now, to save a human life, obviously, there's no question whatsoever. Jewish law says do everything, anything possible to save a human life. And a fetus, by the way. A fetus, we do anything to save a fetus's life because we have a principle called Chalel Alav Shabbat Achat Kedesh Yishmer Shabbos Harbe. You can break one Shabbat because that person, that fetus, will be able to observe many. And I'm trying to be careful about how I refer to fetus as person or fetus. And I'm trying not to be political here at all. I'm trying not to make any implications by the words I use. So please grant me some space, because I'm talking quickly, and so think words just come out. What about the stem cells, though? What about the stem cells? What's its status? So this rabbi realized, if I allow them to turn on the generator to save those stem cells, I'm giving them the status of a human. And now I'm prohibiting research into embryonic stem cells. If I say no, okay, that's sad, we lose them. But if I say yes, I'm giving them higher status than they should have. So he said to them, no, you cannot break Shabbat to save those stem cells, because they do not have in Judaism the status of a human being. Now, he did find other ways to allow it to be turned on. For example, someone who's not Jewish could turn it on, because they're not required to observe the Jewish laws of the Sabbath. So he did turn it on, but have a non-Jew turn it on. What was his source? Why is embryonic stem cell not have the status of a life? Here's the source for why. And Zachary, I see your question there in the chat. I will get to it. So here's the source for this answer of this rabbi. And it's a very interesting source. So it says as follows. Let's just go to the second line here, the main thing for our purposes. It says, Mishum Rabbi Yishmael Amru. According to the school of Rabbi Yishmael, one of the great rabbis of the Talmud, it says, Afal Ubarin, there is a prohibition against killing a fetus. But what's that based on? It says, My time there, Yishmael. What's the source for it says? It says in the Bible, when it actually is talking about capital punishment once again, to Noah, in the days of Noah, it says, here's the verse in the Torah. It really doesn't work in English. You have to read this in Hebrew. It says, Shvoch Dam Ha'adam, Ba'adam Damo Yishafech. The literal translation of that is, if you shed the blood of a person can shed your blood. Meaning, don't think that even though we're very religious, that if someone commits a capital, if someone kills, we just rely on God to punish them. No, the Torah says, if someone kills a person, meaning a human court, has the right to kill them. Like I said, the rabbis in the Talmud, extremely limited capital punishment, but the Torah does allow it. Now, the Talmud, though, said, wait a second. Is this talking about capital punishment? Shvoch dam ha'adam. What, a person who sheds the blood of a person, ba'adam demo yishafech, another person can kill them? No. The rabbi said, ezu adam shehu ba'adam. This is talking about a person, not, see, the bet can mean a lot of things in Hebrew. It's not talking about a person by a person. It's talking about a person within a person. Ezu adam ba'adam. Who's the person within a person? Haviomar ze ubar shebemeimo. That is a fetus within its mother. So the rabbis are saying only a fetus inside its mother's womb has the status of a fetus that cannot be killed. However, a fetus outside the mother's womb, that could be killed, because that is not in a place where it could become a human being. It's currently not in the womb. So it could be killed. And therefore, the rabbi said, Judaism could allow embryonic stem cell research, because that's not even a type of abortion, because it's outside of the womb. And once it's outside of the womb, it certainly has a lower status. However, there is a problem here. Not a problem, but there's another issue here, which is that, what if it's not? What if it is in the womb? I thought we just said at length that Judaism does not consider a fetus to have the status of a life, and therefore it could be killed to save the mother's life. But that source just said a fetus in the womb cannot be killed. And yes, okay, it seemed like it was talking about to Noah. So is that talking to Jews or non-Jews? I mean, to Noah, that could just be Bnei Noah. That could be before the Torah was given. But Tosfos, the rabbis, said, Leika mide the Yisrael shar. There's nothing that to a Jew would be allowed. So it says, Val uberin, the kovid ovid kochavim. That for a non-Jew, we see from that verse, for every human in the world, it's not allowed, but for a Jew, it's allowed. It's certainly not allowed, because you can't have something that's more than in that case for kind of everyone in the world than it is for Jews. And so according to that source, there seems to be a prohibition against abortion. So now what we come to is, we seem to have a little bit of a contradiction. I'll explain everything one more time to wrap it all up, but then I'll give you the specifics. We'll go into the modern day, and I'll tell you some of the real major questions today. Because, first of all, some of the questions today usually are not, most of the questions today are usually not about saving the mother's life. Meaning, yes, of course it happens. And that is a concern. And the rabbis are very clear. If the fetus poses a danger to the mother's life, we kill the fetus to save the mother. But I'll tell you the two questions that are most common today. And I'm saying, in my experience, right, working in a hospital, working with my community, the two most common questions are as follows. And we're going to have to think to ourselves, how do we apply these sources to these questions? Because, you know, today, most of those questions about a woman who's having difficult labor and you'd have to kill the fetus to save her life, oftentimes that's obviated by a C-section. There are ways that, you know, modern medicine has to save both the mother and the fetus. However, two scenarios, like I'll give you two scenarios that are unfortunately somewhat common. Number one, a woman is pregnant. Because she's pregnant, she's going to the doctor more frequently, and or, you know, she's concerned more about symptoms that she felt. She does some testing, and God forbid, lo aleinu, as we say, we should know from this, she finds out that she has cancer. And she's only, you know, let's say 2-3 months pregnant. She still has a ways to go. She finds out she has cancer, and her doctor says, we need to treat this immediately with chemotherapy. That's the only way to save your life. And we need to start chemo now. But the medical protocols are that they will not do this chemotherapy on a pregnant woman. It's too risky to the fetus, not only to kill the fetus, but also to cause many fetal abnormalities, you know, and all kinds of problems that could happen to the potential baby. So the doctor says now, to save your life, it's not because of the labor. It's not even because of the baby. The fetus could be totally innocent, not doing anything to risk the mother's life, except for that the fact that it's there prevents her from beginning chemotherapy. This unfortunately comes up frequently. Another question is genetic screening. I mentioned before, and this leads to two questions. Let's say a woman does various types of testing, whether it's amniocentesis or genetic screening, to find out about the fetus's health. I'm sorry, I promise I'm not just using words. I'm actually more careful about the words I use. I'm not trying to make political implications by the phraseology, but let's say, so she does the screening. She finds out that the fetus is a carrier for some kind of very severe, or has a likelihood of a very severe illness. What was most common in the Jewish community, going back 30, 40 years, was Tay-Sachs. Tay-Sachs was a very, very horrible disease that if a baby had Tay-Sachs, it would die. It would suffer and die certainly within 3-4 years of being born. She finds out that this baby has Tay-Sachs. Or it could be anything else. I mean, you could imagine. There's millions of things it could be, right? Tay-Sachs is a very, very horrible example. You could think something much less severe. Oh, it has a likelihood of having early onset Alzheimer's when it's in its 60s or 70s. You know, obviously that's much, much less severe. But I'm just throwing out there possibilities of what one could find out about their fetus while they're pregnant and should they do something about it. By the way, one of the questions that comes up is, you know, imagine, and this is another question, but it's relevant for this conversation. Imagine a couple is dating. Now, when I do weddings, and I hope everyone does this, but I'm very strict that I will not do a wedding. In fact, I try not to let people even get engaged before they both do genetic screening. They should know, especially in the Jewish community where we have a much smaller gene pool, and there are unfortunately many things that are Jewish genetic diseases and are common and sometimes they're severe. And there are things that can be done about them. So I tell couples, you must do genetic screening. Find out if you're a match. Now, what it used to be, let's say 20 years ago, a couple does testing. They find out that they are both carriers for something. You can imagine. It could be lots of different things. It could be Tay-Sachs, very, very horrible. It could be BRCA, very common, which could lead to breast or ovarian cancer for a woman in her, let's say, in her 30s, or prostate cancer for a man, or other illnesses, let's say. So they find out that they're carriers. Should they get married or not? Should they continue? Let's say they're very much in love. So 30, 40 years ago, most rabbis were telling women, break off the engagement. Men and women, the couples. They were saying, don't get engaged. Why put yourself through this? Some were saying, get married, but only adopt. Only do not risk it. Others were saying, get married, get pregnant, do testing on the fetus, and then have an abortion if you could find out early enough. Some rabbis allow abortion within 40 days, some within 3 months, some other periods of time, which we'll discuss. But those are the only options. And that's why most rabbis were saying, really, you know, this is probably not going to be a successful marriage. This is too much stress on the marriage. Don't get married. A new option exists today. What is it? PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. What's that? That means that the couple, every time they want to get pregnant, they will engage in IVF. They will get pregnant through a lab. In the lab, they will take the egg and the sperm. They will take multiple and impregnate 4 or 5 of the wife's eggs with the husband's sperm. In most cases, okay, it could be donor sperm. There's other scenarios, but let's say that the most common case. Once they have the impregnated egg, the fertilized egg, they're in the lab. They now screen the egg. They screen the fertilized egg, the pre-embryo, and they can then see, okay, does this have that genetic mutation that we are concerned about? They screen 4 or 5 of them. They say, okay, great news. We have 3 of them that are healthy. 3 of them do not have Tay-Sachs or whatever it is that they were concerned about. Oh, by the way, as a side point, they can say, well, 2 out of 3 are boys. The girl is going to have blonde. In the future, we can start saying, well, this color hair, this height, and you start saying lots of different things about that pre-embryo. But anyways, that was another question. Is all this allowed? And based on our analysis from before, we see that once it's outside of the womb, it is allowed. But this becomes another major part of the question. So now that we see those are the modern questions, let's go to the contemporary rabbinic authorities. So I'm just going to show you 2 again, because we're going to start wrapping up soon. I'm going to hear any questions or comments you have. But there were 2 extremes in the Jewish community in the modern era in terms regarding these questions and applying it to abortion. So one was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. And it's fascinating. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein refers to abortion in Hebrew. He was American, but his writings are in Hebrew, but he sometimes writes... he refers to abortion in Hebrew as harigat ha'ubar. Harigat ha'ubar means killing the fetus. And he was very strict. He was very strict about it. In fact, you know, I don't just show this. Yeah, I'll show you in a second. He was so strict. He said it's considered murder. He based that on Maimonides' interpretation that we discussed before. And I'll summarize this all in a second. Let me just put these last 2 steps into it. I'll summarize the whole thing and then we'll open it up. He felt that abortion is murder. He has to admit that, I mean, the Mishnah said if it's risking the woman's life, then it's allowed. So he did say, even though he felt it's murder, in extreme cases, he would allow it to save the woman's life, yes. But otherwise, it would never be allowed, and it should be strictly forbidden. He refers to it as harigat ha'ubar, and even though first point, we should have respect for our great rabbis. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was one of the greatest ever. In fact, I actually have a picture of him right here in my office. That's him right there. He was really one of the greatest ever. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, very uniquely pious and scholar. And we take what he says seriously. We don't start looking for explanations in general. However, he was by far the strictest on this matter. I mean, he came out very strict. And so there became some conversation about why was he so strict? And on the one hand, his understanding of Maimonides, he wrote about that in the 1930s already. So that was when he lived in Russia still. It was before the modern American political world. So he already was of that opinion. And so that was his opinion. But he published this in the late 1960s and early 70s when Roe versus Wade happened. And there were some theories that he was influenced by what was happening in America with permissiveness of abortion. In fact, he seems to write that in his response to the rights. He says it's murder, it's forbidden. He says, Kasafti kol zeh l'inyin ha'pirtza gadol ba'olam. I'm writing this because of the horrible breach that's happening in the world today. Shamalchios d'harei medus have become many countries. Hetiru l'harogu barim are allowing killing fetuses. U'betocham gam Russia, medina b'dinat Yisrael, including Israel. U'kavar n'harogu ubarim l'ein mispar. They've already killed countless amounts of fetuses. Shabazman hazeh ha. Od yesh torah lasot siag l'torah. Therefore, we should be making walls to the Torah and be extra strict about abortion and not allow it because we've become too permissive. That's what Rabbi Feinstein argued. Rabbi Moshe Hauer, who today is the head of the Orthodox Union in America, at this time when he wrote this, he was a rabbi of a major synagogue in Baltimore, Maryland. Today, he is the head rabbi of the Orthodox Union. And he wrote as follows. He said this at a conference, but then it was written up. He said, let me say something a little bit heretical. And now, Rabbi Hauer, just so you know, I mean, he's a right-wing, you know, ultra. He's an Orthodox rabbi. This is not like anti-Torah person talking here. He says, let me say something a little bit heretical. Rav Moshe Feinstein was looking at a world going mad. How many times over this weekend have you heard the term slippery slope? This was at a conference. I would suggest that if he were writing his response on abortion in his old community in Russia in the 1930s, he would likely have said that abortion is not the right thing and is not allowed under most circumstances, but maybe allowed under certain specific conditions. But here he was in the United States, and the world around him was sliding toward a freewheeling culture of abortion on demand. At that moment, every part of Feinstein said, oh my gosh, where are we headed? And so he came out with the statement that abortion is murder. So that's Rabbi Hauer's theory on why Rav Moshe was so strict about abortion. He saw it as murder, despite the sources we saw above. And in fact, one of his family members argued that actually it was something else. Rabbi Shabtai Rappaport, who edited some of Feinstein's books, who was the son-in-law of Rabbi Feinstein's son-in-law, Rabbi Professor Tendler, so, you know, like a grandson, told me that Rabbi Feinstein's position on this matter was influenced by Nazi medical crimes. It was right after the Holocaust. He was concerned about, you know, things that had happened, mistrust for doctors, obviously death of many Jews, and so he was very strict about abortion. That was one extreme. Rabbi Feinstein was one extreme, very strict about abortion, allowing it in some circumstances, but not most. On the other extreme was Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. In fact, I'll move this down so it's all on one page. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg was the rabbi of Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, also coming from the ultra-Orthodox world, and a very, very important and very scholarly rabbi. He wrote, and let me just explain it real quick, and then I'll just read you a bit about his reasoning. Now, if Rabbi Moshe Feinstein argued that abortion is murder, what, you know, if you say it's murder, that it's going to lead you to be being pretty strict. But there are other theories. Some rabbis said, no, the prohibition, if there is a prohibition, we saw it shouldn't be just allowed willy-nilly, clearly. Even those rabbis in the Talmud that allowed it didn't want to allow it unless there was a need for it. So why wouldn't it be allowed in every situation? So they said it's not a prohibition of murder. It's a prohibition of what's called in Hebrew, chavala, which means damages, damaging. You're not supposed to damage someone. That actually fits great into the verse we read in the Torah, which said, right, if you kill a fetus, you have to pay damages. Now, damages are allowed in Judaism if they're for a purpose. So let's say, just as a side example, cosmetic surgery. Does Judaism allow cosmetic surgery? So if one's concerned about their looks could be a valid reason. So then, yes, it's allowed. If it's just, you know, wanton, you know, for fun, for not for a good reason, you know, the rabbis don't like it. But if it's for a valid reason, someone, you know, for emotional reasons, it's allowed. We can damage our bodies, so to speak, when it's for when we have justification for why I want to do it. Rabbi Waldenberg argued that abortion only falls under the rabbinic prohibition of, not even the Torah level, the rabbinic level prohibition of damaging one's body. And therefore, for a strong enough need, it's allowed. And he allowed abortions up until viability. So up until like the seventh month, he was allowing abortions very far into the pregnancy. And as long as there was a strong enough need, and his argument was not just, the Talmud seems to imply that if the mother's life is physically in danger, right? The fetus is somehow risking her life, and you can only save her life by killing the fetus. Then the rabbi said, you could do it. What about if her life is emotionally at risk from the fetus? The emotional risk to her life is so severe from gestating, from continuing to have this fetus and giving birth to it, that she must terminate the pregnancy to save her life emotionally, right? Her mental health, her mental well-being. He said that counts too. That would be enough of a reason. And look at his reasoning, the way he writes it. I find it to actually be very profound and significant the way he writes it. So at the conclusion of his entire presentation, he says as follows. He says, Himgein, Hagab Atzmecha, listen, Im Yesh Torah, if there's a need, Tsar V'Ka'ev, emotional pain or physical pain, Yoter Gadol Mizeh Shel Nidonino. Is there any pain worse than this is talking about having a child with Tay-Sachs? That's a child, as we said before, who will be born very sick, will suffer for 3 or 4 years, and certainly die by its fifth birthday. Is there anything more painful than that? Emotionally, he's saying, not physically. Asher Yigrom La'em Behavlad La Yitzur Kazeh. That will cause the mother more pain than that, to see their baby die. Shekula Omer Yisrimu Koavim Misaso Betuach. That will be completely full of pain and suffering and a certain death. The Meshech Mispar Shanim, within a few years. Ve'einei Ahorim Ro'os, and the parents of this child will see. The Kalos Be'ein La'el Yadam, and they'll be crying out to God, Loshia, for salvation. Ubor Shalom Mishane Velo Machit Klum. It actually doesn't matter at all. Be'im Ha'yilud Hazel Yilkach L'Mosad. Whether or not they're going to give this child to an institution, a special institute, miyuchad v'lo yitznu gisha lahorim ad moto, and then the parents won't see the child until the death. It's still just as bad, he argues. umetosef lezeh pitule hasrim. This will cause so much more pain. Umekoavim shall yilud, and pain from the child, the atzma, the pain, it's the child itself will suffer so much, have such a life of suffering, of torment, shalaleinu kol mumbo, that will have every possible deformity and defect and suffer. Ulechein, therefore, im yesh lahatir al pi halacha, if it's allowed to, if I'm allowed to permit, according to halacha, hafsakat harayon. Now that is a very, very important word. What does he call abortion? According to the Tzitz Eliezer, abortion is called hafsakat harayon, ending a pregnancy. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who is very strict, called it killing a fetus. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who allows it, calls it ending a pregnancy. Very different way of looking at it, you see? Biglal sorach gadol ubiglal ka'evim v'yisurim, because of a great need and great pain. Nira shezeo ha-mikra ha-klasi. This seems to be the classic situation that we can allow abortions, because it's causing so much pain. Just like it was causing the death, the risk to the life of the mother physically, so too emotionally. It doesn't matter what type of pain it's causing. Gufim o nafshim. Physical or emotional pain. V'yisurim v'ka'evim nafshim heima b'midah merubam harbe yoter gedolim v'yoter mechaevim yisurim gufim. And actually he argues, this is a very profound point, emotional suffering can be much worse than physical pain. The emotional suffering is much worse. V'nasan ol barzel al tzivareif. And it puts an iron weight on the neck of the mother or the parents. U'mefarish b'Yerushalmi, and as the Yerushalmi explains. U'befrat b'keilei shlom, and especially in this case of the Tay-Sachs baby, shibhar bei pa'amim mevim betotzoseim, that oftentimes leads to lidei hatkafot ufaniyot chamurot. It even leads to physical pain of the parents. Oftentimes they have nirov v'yagon from the great suffering they have, b'hatkaf lei, with heart problems, right, organ problems, and digestion problems, shigayon, and mental health. Who can understand this, how horrible this is? And so this is Tzitz Eliezer, this great rabbi, allowed abortions up until the seventh month and potentially even later if necessary, and he was very lenient. He was considered the most lenient on abortion. Rabbi Feinstein was considered the most strict, and everyone else kind of fell somewhere in between. In fact, I know of stories personally where people asked one rabbi that was more of the opinion of Rabbi Moshe, and that rabbi was so distraught to hear the sad story from the people in front of him, they said to them, you know what, go ask Rabbi Waldenberg, go ask Tzitz Eliezer, see what he says. They would purposely send them to him because they knew what answer they would get. But let me just summarize and then close, and I'll deal with the questions in the chat and put in any other questions you have there. So the summary is as follows. We saw that the Torah really seems to imply that killing a fetus, killing a human, necessitates capital punishment. Killing a fetus is monetary, so it has a lower level. We did see that the Septuagint and the Catholic Church after that interpreted that verse differently and came to a different conclusion. But the rabbinic understanding of that verse was that a fetus has monetary damage. It's considered damaging, but it's not considered a life, which was, in fact, buttressed by the rabbis in the Mishnah. The rabbi said, to save a woman's life who's having difficult labor, you kill a fetus, even if that means cutting it up. I did point out as a side point, of course, that's not so simple. It's not just like taking a pill and you go home. We should know that it's an emotionally burdensome and even physically burdensome act, but it's still, the rabbi said, it's allowed. In fact, maybe not just allowed, maybe obligatory to terminate the pregnancy in order to save the mother's life. Then we saw that there was different interpretations of why, though. And by the way, there's other sources in the rabbis in the Talmud that say the same thing about ending, killing a fetus to save a woman's life. Anyways, then we saw that there was two interpretations. Rashi said that's because it's not a life until it's born, until it comes out. Okay, we talked about modern issues if it's the same when it comes to, fetal surgeries. Does that mean it's all of a sudden a life? Okay, well, we'll have to talk one day about ectogenesis, where what if you have a fetus gestated entirely outside of the womb? What would that mean? At what point does it come to life? Okay, these are all going to be modern questions, but clearly it's not a life until it's born, Rashi said. Lav nefesh, it doesn't have a soul, or it's not a life. status of life until the baby is born, until it's alive in the world, not from conception or any time earlier, even though there are different stages that in the first 40 days, the rabbis considered a fetus just to be mere water, to have very low status. For the first 3 months, the rabbis consider it until it has form also to have a lower status, but the Sitz of the Ezra said until viability. Then we saw, though, however, Maimonides seemed to be stricter because he said the reason you can kill the fetus to save the mother is because the fetus is like a rodent. It's coming to kill. And therefore, Moshe Feinstein said abortion is murder. It's only allowed to save the life. Whereas the Sitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, said, nope, it's just damages and it can be allowed to either save the mother's life emotionally or physically. We also saw that outside of the womb, it certainly doesn't have the status of a life, and therefore that allows much more types of fertility treatments. And to conclude, I'll just show you the last two sources, and then I want to start going to your questions and conversation. It is important to point out, Rabbi Howard Jachter, I think he made an important point. I've just given you a basic overview of the Jewish sources. There's so much more to say on the topic. So Rabbi Jachter pointed out that he once heard of Aaron Lichtenstein in a first conversation once compared a rabbi rendering a halakhic decision in area abortion to a physician conducting a liver transplant. Just as an ordinary physician should not perform a liver transplant, so too an ordinary rabbi should not render a decision regarding abortion. Only a rabbi of eminent stature may render a decision regarding abortion because it's very complicated. And Rev Aaron himself, you know, this is a contemporary issue because now that we have artificial intelligence and people are even talking about making AI rabbis. Horrible idea. Put me out of a job. No, I'm joking. I am. So Rev Lichtenstein said, a sensitive posek has to recognize, we just saw all these sources, right? The gravity of the personal situation, right, of the mother, and the seriousness of the halachic factors. He might stretch the halachic limits of leniency where serious domestic tragedy looms, or hold firm to the strict interpretation of the law when, as serious the situation, the pressure for leniency stems from frivolous attitudes and reflects a debased moral compass. This approach is neither evasive nor discriminatory, but it's case by case. That's his point. The flexibility arises from a recognition that halachic rulings are not and should not be the output of human microcomputers, but of thinking human beings. A recognition that these rulings must be applied to concrete situations with a bold effort to achieve the optimal moral halakhic balance among the various factors. So the Jewish approach is very nuanced. We have to balance all these factors. Abortion is allowed. The fetus is not a human, but it's not something that we encourage or I think this is just a great thing, right? The fetus is a potential life. We can violate Shabbat to save a fetus because it is a potential life, right? We do care about that life. We always want to care about the vulnerable. And in this case, the vulnerable oftentimes could be the mother. It also could be the fetus. So we are stretched and we have to really be flexible and sensitive and really weigh these issues carefully. And like I said, they don't all fit neatly to the box. What about that woman who finds out she has cancer and needs an abortion to start chemotherapy? Is that fetus coming to chase her life? Well, it's not the fetus's fault. But then again, we saw the mother's life has status of a human, whereas the fetus's life is not a status of a human. So therefore, many rabbis do allow ending the pregnancy in order to begin chemotherapy. In fact, most allow it. In fact, some really strongly encourage it, not just allow it. Because it's not always that the mother wants to do it. Sometimes they say, no, let me get through this pregnancy. Let me do whatever I can. And it's excruciating, these questions. Sometimes it's their only child. It's their first pregnancy. It's been after years of fertility treatments. You know, these are not easy questions. But you see that there is nuance and there's flexibility, and it's a big challenge. So we just have a couple minutes left, but I want to have some conversation and discussion. You said, Zachary, miscarriage after a certain date of gestation, there's a funeral, yet no status as a wife. We do have the funeral, that's true, but the funeral is not obligatory.
Could you just, would you be able to, any questions that you read from the chat, could you just speak out the questions for the people in the class?
Physically. So I read the question was, what about if miscarriage after a certain date of gestation, there's a funeral, yet no status as a life? So we do the funeral because, we hope that's comforting. And there is a status, meaning it's not a status of a full human life, but there's something. And there's even, you know, mystical things. We sometimes believe that. Sometimes, for example, a baby boy, a fetus boy that dies in gestation. The tradition is to give it a bris. They actually give it a bris and then bury it, even though it was never born. And sometimes they say, you know, Kabbalistically, spiritually, mystically, maybe that fetus was just born as a reincarnation that just needed to have a bris. Like, we don't know these things. We don't understand. And also, it does have the status of, a limb, for example. A limb we bury also. because we're worried about a kohen. A kohen can't come in contact with even a limb. So too a fetus has the status certainly of a limb. And so we bury it to prevent that contamination from a kohen. That's the reason, Zachary. Then Raphael Solomon said, well, you discuss abortion where the reason is wholly unrelated to medical reasons, i.e. the mother cannot afford to keep the baby. Now, if it's strictly financial, there are many organizations, you know, and hopefully they'll increase now, but there are many organizations that will help people. In fact, I remember a case we once had where we had a woman come to our community from Israel. A teenager came, and that's because she was pregnant, and her community didn't want people to know that she was pregnant. So they paid for her to live in L.A. for a year, have the baby. Someone adopted the baby. Then she moved back, and she told people, oh, I just went to live in, you know, I went to like this kind of a seminary in L.A. for a year, and they don't even know she had the baby. I mean, there's organizations that will help with adoption or whatever it is. But to the sources that I mentioned of the emotional suffering, I mean, you could imagine a case where the financial constraints of someone having a baby could be so overwhelming, and their ability to connect to those resources are limited, where you could imagine a case where it's so emotionally overwhelming that abortion could be justified because of the emotional pain, you know, toll it would take. So, you know, everything's case by case. So, you'd have to come up with a case that would fit into it. So we wouldn't go there first, right? We'd see, well, are there other things we could do to support someone financially if that's the only reason for the abortion? But you could imagine such a case where the rabbis would allow it, even in financial considerations. In certain extreme situations, you could imagine such a case. Other comments, questions? Yeah, rape or incest. It's the same calculations. Many rabbis do allow abortion in cases of rape and incest, and it's for very similar reasons. The emotional toll of having that child could be so overwhelming that that justifies the abortion. So many rabbis allow in those cases. Invited me to speak, they said, you know, take time for questions and fist fights. So I hope I haven't upset anyone so much that there's any question. If so, good thing we're on Zoom. I'll just exit the Zoom and say, see ya.
there's a question in the audience. If you want to come up here or
I'm joking. I really tried to be, I'm trying not to even say my own opinion. I'm just trying to give you the sources and kind of the issues so that let you draw your own conclusions.
My question is not an easy conversation.
I totally understand why it's so upsetting. Yes.
When they do the in vitro fertilization, and then they check to see if the embryo contains, let's say, the Tay-Sachs gene. So yeah. If there is no bad gene, then the embryo gets into the womb. What happens to the other embryos that do test positive?
Yes, excellent question. So. Because of the fact that the rabbi said that a fetus, an embryo, a fertilized embryo outside of the womb does not have that status, right? Because it's hashofech dam ba'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech, as we saw, so it can be discarded. In fact, not only can it be discarded, the rabbis prefer it to be discarded. Either discarded or used for scientific research. Why? Because there's a concern that if you keep embryos, these fertilized embryos, and give it to someone else, then your children could have siblings that they don't know that they have, and they could accidentally one day marry their siblings, and that has happened before. So the rabbi said, either discard it, that's allowed because it doesn't have status at all, or you can use it for scientific research. That's totally fine. That's a great use because that could save other lives. Yes, Zachary, I see a hand up.
Okay, it's actually Faggy. I was going to ask something along the similar lines. You talked about young couples where they're both carriers for potential problems. Yep. Fetuses where they do in vitro and they examine each of the, each of the embryos to see if they're healthy. So say they have three healthy ones, they implant one of them randomly. So the other two are potentially healthy babies. Same thing, would they just discard them because they might end up marrying a sibling, or would they just use them for medical research, or could they freeze them and save them to have a child 2 years down the road?
Yes, oftentimes they will freeze them, save them for later. And, okay. You know, that's proven to be very successful, or given to medical research. It's by Jewish law, it is very problematic to give them to someone else to use because of the concern. The only way that rabbis ever allow it, even though they strongly discourage it, is if it's totally open, meaning they know exactly who the people are and they know who the child is. so they can try their best to then prevent them from marrying each other. And the truth is, in America, it's pretty uncommon. I mean, it's such a big country, but it has happened. It has happened in America, and I know cases in Israel where it happens. It's a much smaller country, and it's more, you know, possible. And I guess you could see why someone, you know, people fall in love with, you know, their sibling. Like, oh, wow, they have traits that they like, and then, you know, it's really can be tragic once they find out. And dangerous, you know, it could be medically dangerous also.
You know, in the very firm community, when you're meeting people only through Shadchanim, there's an organization called Rolador where you go for testing to see if you're a carrier, and they won't even let you meet somebody, but go on a date with somebody if you're not a good match.
Right, Dor Yesharim, I did that when I got...
Dor Yesharim, that's what it's called.
But, right, I encourage people to do open genetic testing where they can actually find out the results. See, it's much more, you know, you can make the decisions and determine the level of risk you're willing to take and things like that. But yes, right, you're right.
Okay.
I think we're out of time. I'm more than happy to take more questions, but I know that we're over time now.
Yeah, I think there's about 20 future topics. So we'll end here, and hopefully we will see you again, Rabbi Wiener. And thank you so much.
I think it was
tremendously informative. We very much appreciate it. And have a wonderful rest of your morning.
Thank you.